do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. May we be blessed by the challenge of this word. And in the gospel lesson this morning, from the Gospel of Matthew chapter 16, we see a turning point in the narrative about Jesus' life. In the prior lines and from last week's lesson, you'll recall, Peter has confessed that Jesus was the Christ, the Messiah. But then in this passage, the tone turns more somber as Jesus explains exactly what kind of Messiah he will be, a suffering Messiah. Here is the gospel of Jesus Christ, according to Matthew. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord, this must never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, you are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." Then Jesus told his disciples, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? For the Son of Man is to come with his angels and the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone for what has been done. Truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming into his kingdom." May we be blessed by the hearing of this good news. Well, as I said in the announcement, summer is just about over. And certainly here at church, this marks the closing of our summer season. We're on the cusp of yet another church year. This time of year is always big in our life. And yet this year, it is even bigger with all of the changes. We've changed our schedule of worship to 8 and 10 a.m. beginning next Sunday. We've got a new expanded hour in between for kids and for adults. We've even managed to get a little bit of new space, as I hope you've seen out here in the atrium, by taking out some of the coat racks, making a bigger space for fellowship and coffee and welcome. There'll eventually be furniture in there that will serve on Sunday mornings as a good spot, kind of the grand central station of First Church as people scurry about going to and from their various activities. It's a big change for the church. And in this time of year, we're probably facing many of us other changes. New schools for some of the kids if they're going from elementary to middle or to high school. New routines. The fall season always marks an increase in the pace of life from the theoretically lazier days of summer, though I'm not sure if they're necessarily lazier for us here at church, but I guess they are to some degree. In the fall, temperatures cool. The earth grows at first more green in the grass, and then the foliage turns and eventually goes into hibernation. So in this season, we sense and experience and see a shift in things. We're in transition to a new season, a new schedule, new activities, new things. The flow of life is changing. So maybe this morning, in this sort of in-between Sunday, it's good to look at change, to look at the flow of life, and to ponder our place in it. As I pondered the scriptures for this morning, the lessons for this morning, what came up for me was the theme of intention, the divine intention or God's intention, and the response of the human intention to that divine call. And in the Old Testament lesson, we heard that very familiar story of Moses at the burning bush. We see God calling Moses, and it was an odd choice. We think of Moses as Charlton Heston, but you know, the the scriptures say that Moses was a shepherd. He stuttered, he was insecure, unsure of himself. And yet God, speaking to him, this great God of the cosmos, this God of the galaxies, says that you will deliver my people. And we see Moses' reaction. Me? Who, me? Who am I that I should go and free the slaves? Now, the saga continues past this morning's lesson, of course, and Rob mentioned the humor. There really is, if you see it, there really is a kind of a lighthearted refraction to this thing. Moses continues to bargain with God. And finally, Moses says, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." You know, he's just really clear about it. At that point, God gets really ticked and says, "Good grief, I'll give you what you need. My words will be your words. Go and do it. As Nike says, just do it." And belatedly, Moses moves his intent in line with God's intent and moves not under his own human power. This is an important point. But under God's power, and begins the difficult process of leading the Israelites to their promised land. Now, as Rob mentioned, notice that God expects this mere Moses to free the slaves. It's a rather surprising storyline if you hadn't heard it so often before this morning. This God who commands the cosmos, this God who, as our opening song said, spins the whirling planets, this God who orders a burning bush to appear and yet the bush itself is oddly not consumed by the fire, sees that the people must be freed, and you think, well, this great God of power and majesty would just free the slaves. But instead, he expects this Moses, this mere mortal, this human, to go and do it. God expects a human to go and to do essentially what is divine work. And God promises Moses that God will be with Moses in that effort. "I will be with you," God says. So we see right off in this first lesson that being a religious person is not merely believing, but it's moving, moving under the command and under the power of God. It is going somewhere. It is doing something. It is responding to God's call and to God's action in our lives. God did not call Moses into a passive religiosity. And in the Christian experience that follows that experience of Moses among the early fellowship of Jesus' followers, neither do we see God calling them to a passive religious experience. Jesus rebukes Peter after Jesus announces his intention to suffer and be killed. Of course, it's not really Jesus' original intention to go to the cross. Technically speaking, it is God's intention, to which Jesus responds. Jesus aligns his will with the divine will, as we see in the larger narrative. This did not fit Peter's hopes, and he rebukes Jesus, hoping this would never have to happen. And Jesus tells him, in essence, to reframe his thinking. Reframe his thinking from human things to divine things. To realize that Jesus must go to the cross, and moreover, that his followers must also take up their crosses and follow him. Now, this idea in our day of taking up your cross generally means to carry the burdens that we carry. Everybody, it is said, has a cross to bear. But perhaps what Jesus is talking about here is risk. To take up your cross is to risk death. We have to remember that in this early community forming around Jesus, the people who were following this new and strange Messiah were not considered honorable or respectful by the larger society. In fact, doing so invited shame and derision. It placed one at risk of losing everything, even one's life. It is different today, for sure. It is widely perceived in our society that the churchgoer is rather conventional, that attending church is something that is good to do, it is something that a good citizen does, it is something that is honorable and respectful. But such in Jesus' day was not true. Jesus, and we see this expressed in so many other gospel accounts as well, Jesus was not calling people to a conventional faith, to a faith of the known or a faith of the status quo. In fact, He was doing just the opposite. He was calling people away from the limiting conventions of that day toward a new faith, toward a new experience with God, toward a new and bold and dynamic and rich and risky life, a life that enlarged the accepted boundaries of the day, a life that welcomed children as we have this morning, a life that welcomed all without exception, a life that welcomed those outside the purity code of the day, a life that welcomed all to the fellowship and to the wider mission in the life of God. We see this new ethic expressed by Paul in the New Testament lesson from Romans. For Paul, obedience to the covenant with God and Jesus Christ, so says one scholar, Beverly Gavanta, is, she says, not merely a matter of keeping rules. It is an act of being massively and completely transformed, readied for a new life in the world, which is marked by liberality and by hospitality. Paul provides an inventory for new life for those who are changed and renewed by the gospel, she says. So for Paul, as for Jesus, as for Moses, once Moses gets the message, that is, being in the household of God had nothing to do with an ordinary faith as then understood. In each of these examples, we see divinity calling humanity not to the conventional mores of that society, but to a life of intention, using our human powers in line with our experience and understanding of the divine life. In other words, it matters what we do. It matters in the big things, and it matters in the daily and mundane things. It matters how we live. It matters how we need to live to stay in the flow of divine life. But such is not always easy. In fact, I think it is rarely easy. It is not easy for us to change what becomes for us the regular and routine, and we are creatures of habit, all of us. And no doubt we could each tell stories of the habits we have, sometimes good and sometimes not so good. Just this last Tuesday in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, columnist and psychotherapist Philip Shard wrote about the challenge of change, of how so many of us say we are open to change and personal transformation, and of course that's kind of a buzzword, you know, about personal transformation. But he says really how few of us are up to the challenges of that personal transformation because of our fear of the unknown. He said in the column, I've worked with countless clients who, and this is great imagery, who upon reaching the edge of their mental diving board, elected not to leap into their new me, So he says, if you've been on a mission to remake yourself for some portion of your life, but have had little success, try examining the benefits you accrue from staying the same. I was reflecting in my own history. Years ago, I quit smoking. And this may strike you as strange that I ever smoked, but there was a day when there was a constant cloud of smoke that just kind of, an odor that went with me wherever I was. And it wasn't until, and I tried to quit and was not successful, and it wasn't until the benefits of not quitting, the benefits of quitting exceeded the benefits of not quitting, that I was able then to quit, and it turned out rather effortlessly. So, you know, in that small way, I kind of know what he's talking about. It's difficult leaving what we are used to. It's difficult getting outside of the tracks that we run in because they are familiar, they are known. Even if what we are used to isn't that great or is no longer working for us. Moses could probably more clearly see the benefits of staying as a shepherd in the fields instead of facing up to what God calls him to do, facing up to the military and political powers of his day. Peter did not want to lose his beloved master, of course, but by letting go of the familiar in each case, each was taken to a new place. Not comfortable at all, but a place where their work could make God and God's household more manifest in the world. but it is not easy. We want to hold to the familiar. One of my favorite songs for me that is not really a religious song, but for me is intensely spiritual, and I would even call it religious, is a song by Garth Brooks. Now, I've got the accent for country western music, but in reality, I don't like the stuff that much, and I assume that you guys have heard of Garth Brooks. Did Garth make it all the way up here from? Okay, good. I was hoping so, or my illustration here would be lost on you. It's a country western song, of course. And I discovered it about 10 years ago, and it spoke to me then, and it continues to speak to me about journeys, about our life journeys, and about my life journey. As I said, he does not use, except in one quick stanza, anything particularly religious, but it is deeply evocative to me of the human and thus the spiritual journey. And I would sing it if I could, but you wouldn't want me to do that, so I will recite it as poetry. The song opens. You know, a dream is like a river, ever changing as it flows. And a dreamer is just a vessel that must follow where it goes, here, there, the divine intention. Trying to learn from what's behind you and never knowing what's in store makes each day a constant battle just to stay between the shores. And I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry. Like a bird upon the wind, these waters are my sky. I'll never reach my destination if I never try. So I will sail my vessel, there's a human intention, till the river runs dry. The river is God's will for creation. There is a certain flow in life that moves in concert with God's will for us and for all. Now, we get lost in that flow sometimes. We get lost perhaps in a tributary that doesn't go in the direction we need it to. Perhaps we get stuck up on the shore. Perhaps we try with all of our might to swim in the opposite direction, but there is a flow to life and a flow to God's life that we cannot control. This is God's intention. And yet, this does not mute our human intention, our human powers. Garth says, I will sail my vessel. Now, I have never sailed, but I have observed sailing. And it seems that it takes great skill and sometimes strength and sometimes cunning to sail successfully. It looks easy, but it really has a lot more to it than it appears. It's not merely getting your boat out into the lake or the ocean or the river and throwing up the sails and going with the flow. It is using the strength of the water and the power of the wind and one's own power, one's own skills, one's own intention to get where you need to go. So Garth says, I will sail my vessel till the river runs dry, till one's life has completed its course. Of course, we sometimes get stuck in the daily conventions of our lives. If we lose track of where we're supposed to be going, life passes us by in the second stanza. Too many times we stand aside and let the water slip away till we put off till tomorrow, till what we put off till tomorrow has now become today. So don't you sit upon the shoreline and say you're satisfied. Choose to chance the rapids and dare to dance the tide. Dare to dance the tide. Dare to align your intent with the divine intent. Dare to give yourself over to God's will and to God's work. Dare to move beyond mere convention, beyond mere politeness, beyond mere niceness, beyond what society expects of you or of me. Dare to dance the tide of the amazing transformation of life in God with and through Jesus Christ, and in the community of Jesus Christ, our church. Garth merely expresses in popular music an idea that is as old as the Christian faith itself. Irenaeus said in the 2nd century, it is not you who shape God. It is God that shapes you. If then you are the work of God, await the hand of the artist, who does all things in due season. offer the potter your heart, soft and tractable, and keep the form in which the artist has fashioned you. Let your clay be moist, lest you grow hard and lose the imprint of the potter's fingers. Staying soft and moist is another metaphor for staying flexible, for being open to change, open to the ongoing intention of God in our lives, inviting us to move our lives from our little conventions to holy intentions. It leaves us open and attentive to hear God's call, and moreover, to respond to that call in our lives. So may it be. Amen.